Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Marco Patterson. On today's edition of Jaws of Justice, radio host Craig Lubow talks with Lance LaRusso, author and attorney, about his newest book, Blue News, a guide for police officers and police departments on how to interact with the press after an officer-involved killing. We won't have a calendar of events this week, but listen for the 420 drug war news at the end of the show. Up next is Craig and his guest.
Okay, this is Craig Lubow. Thank you, Margo. And today's guest I have on, Lance LaRusso. As Margo indicated, he is an attorney. He practices in Georgia. He is a former police officer, and he has represented and continues to represent police officers who have been involved in police officer shootings and advises them, and also has a blog called The Blue Line Lawyer. Welcome, Lance.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. Let me have you, you also have a new book that you released recently. Can you tell us what that's about a little bit?
Sure. This book is called Blue News. Like all the other books I've written, all the profits go to law enforcement charities. And Blue News is about the intersection of law enforcement and the media. So it talks about how the media covers law enforcement and how the relationships develop and sometimes fall apart between the media and law enforcement, and how incidents, specifically critical incidents and officer-involved shootings, get reported in the media and why.
All right. And some people, when they hear about books like this, they also want to know about how are the officers held accountable and how do you strike a balance between how things are perceived in the media and the rights of police officers, but at the same time holding officers accountable for incidents where they are at fault.
Sure, and that's one of the first books that I read. That I wrote was called When Cops Kill, The Aftermath of a Critical Incident. And I wrote that book to give the public, the media, and law enforcement an idea of what they can expect after, let's say, an officer-involved shooting. And using as an example an officer-involved shooting where someone dies, the media really is dealing with a public that is not familiar with anything other than television and fiction novels about an officer-involved shooting. So if you're watching TV, an officer gets involved in a shooting and they're at their desk the next day. And that's just not what happens. In the situation where you have a death, there's a homicide investigation, just like any other homicide investigation, by criminal investigators. The officer is interviewed as a suspect. There is an internal investigation. People call it internal affairs. It's an administrative investigation focused on training, liability for the department, policies, whether or not the officer acted appropriately, whether or not they used the tools, and whether or not they're given, whether or not their training was adequate. And then you have a prosecutorial inquiry that will look into, again, whether any criminal laws were violated. Then even after, if the officer's cleared of in all of those three, the officer can still face a civil suit, which is another form of accountability, and the federal investigators on the federal level of the judiciary can also look at that situation. So there are many levels of accountability that are just not seen when people look at these situations. They think that the officer just says, well, I was in fear of my life, and that's the end of it. But these investigations typically take months, and they are very thorough.
Yeah. Some people, though, when they look at the percentage of officers who are ultimately charged, I think I've seen figures that maybe less than 1% of the officers who are involved in shootings are ever charged. Now, that's not to say that that may be appropriate. May be those weren't all justified, but that raises some concern and red flags with some people.
It does, and it's interesting because I think they don't understand it from a standpoint of what happens nationally. So just to follow up on that, there was actually an MSNBC study in 2016 that said that of all the complaints filed against officers, it was something like 9% something is found to be irregular, and in 0.9%, the officer discipline resulted from it, and the officer was found to have done something wrong. So we have a lot of complaints, and the complaints are increasing. But when we look at an officer's use of deadly force, I've looked at statutes from all over the country, and there may be a word or two different, but the use of deadly force for law enforcement is not much different than private citizens, by the way. There's only two small distinctions between a private citizen's ability to use deadly force and law enforcement. But the words are going to vary very little, because it all comes back to the Constitution of the United States, the Fourth Amendment, and the cases that come out of the United States Supreme Court. So let's go back to that training. We take an officer, we put them in the police academy, we train them in the books and have them read the law. We train them in the classroom. We put them out on the range to make sure they're accurate. And then we put them through high-stress scenarios to make sure they can think under pressure. And then every year we retrain them and reevaluate them. So it actually should not be a surprise when an officer uses deadly force, and they do so according to the law. That's exactly what they're trained to do, is follow the law under high-stress circumstances. The problem we have, and it's been a trend that I've noticed over the past few years, we have a shooting. There's very little facts that are released to the public, and some that aren't known, such as the toxicology of the suspect who may have been assaulting an officer. We have absolutely reckless comments by people who sometimes were thousands of miles away when it happened. Then the investigation takes place. It clears the officer. And then the people who were screaming for the officer's head now realize they were wrong. And rather than admitting they were wrong, they say there's a problem with the system.
All right. Let's talk about some cases specifically. We have a lot of these cases that were videotaped taken of incidents. In some cases, I think there was one case recently in Texas where the officer was fired. The officer involved in the Tamir Rice shooting in Cleveland was just fired within the past month. I think that happened about a year or 2 years ago.
Right.
And so if when the department looks at that and they deem the officer's behavior to be inappropriate and the use of force not to be appropriate, if they're in agreement with that, and if they agree with the accounts of it in the media, why is it that it's so hard to get convictions and charge them in the criminal case?
All right. Well, first of all, the officer in the Tamir Rice shooting was fired, but he was not fired for anything related to the shooting. He was fired for something that had to do with his application process, and that's exactly what I'm talking about. You'll tell people, well, people will say, well, it took 2 years to fire him after the shooting, but he was ruled to be justified during the shooting by a grand jury. But there's a difference between someone violating a policy or violating a rule or using inappropriate tactics and being disciplined and fired and someone violating the law. There's a very, very big difference there. And I think that's what gets lost when people say, well, I looked at the video. Well, part of the problem with the video, lawful self-defense, lawful use of force. So if I grab you, if you're coming out of the building one night and I grab you around the neck and try to take your wallet and you punch me and stomp on my foot and punch me in the throat and then run away, that's not going to look good on video. It never will. And the other problem is when you're looking at the use of force, the camera will never tell you the officer's view of what happened. Cameras have no peripheral vision. Cameras do not move the same way an officer's head moves. And cameras do not see the same in low light or no light situations as an officer, which is generally where these situations occur. So when people say, well, I saw the video and it looks to me that, you know, the officer acted inappropriately, the first problem you have is, when you say it looks like that to you, well, what is your training? Do you understand the United States Supreme Court, in a case called Graham versus Connor, has said that you need to look at the officer's actions in the light of a reasonable police officer, not a reasonable person. And then second, you can't take into account that the view that you see on the video is everything that the officer saw.
Okay. Okay. What about, let's talk about a little bit about that Walter Scott case, because I think that was a situation where the suspect was actually running away.
Right.
So tell me what your thoughts are on that case, then.
It was an interesting case from the perspective of the procedure. It was terrible. The man lost his life. And, you know, that's a tragedy whenever that occurs. There was some interesting things from a procedural standpoint. It was obvious and everybody understood that the camera was turned on somewhere in the middle of the interaction. If you look at the officer in North Charleston, Scott is running away, but there was even the person I think who took the video agreed that there was a confrontation that took place before that. So the case went forward. He was charged very quickly. It went forward to a jury, and the jury did not convict him. And it was interesting when I was asked about that. I was interviewed right after, and I said, you know, we've always known there was more on that video than we were able to see, or there was more to the encounter that we were, than we were able to see. Well, apparently the jury saw all of it. Then we pop up, and I assumed there was going to be a re-prosecution, that they were going to bring the charges again, because I think it was a hung jury, and he pled guilty. And when we look at that, the question is, what charges did he plead guilty to? What was offered to him? But in that situation, the police department acted very swiftly. They looked at it. They did their investigation. This is the criminal part of the investigation. They decided that he had acted inappropriately, and they made an arrest.
All right. Now, one of the things you're saying is that oftentimes, which is correct, that video may not capture, there may have been something that happened before the video was turned on. But then in a case like that, even if something happened, even if that Walter Scott had attacked the officer, if he was running away at that point and he was no longer a threat to the officer, doesn't that change that then, as far as what the officer is justified?
No, it doesn't. See, that statement indicates that there's a gap here in understanding of the laws of use of deadly force. An officer is justified in shooting someone in the back. They're justified in shooting someone who's running away, even if there's no threat present to the officer at that time under certain situations. The case is Garner versus Tennessee. If an officer believes a person is armed, they've committed a forcible felony. I'm not talking about the Walter Scott case. If a person commits a forcible felony, say an aggravated assault on an officer, they beat the officer with his own nightstick, and then he's running away. He's still armed, and the officer believes he's a threat to the community. The officer can lawfully shoot the suspect in the back. And that's an example of what I'm talking about. People say, well, he was shot in the back. First of all, a person can point a gun at an officer and shoot them and have their back to the officer. People shoot over their shoulders. They shoot under their arms. As a matter of fact, if you look in the news about 3 days ago, a Chicago police officer was shot by a woman who leaned the gun over her shoulder while she was running full speed forward and shot the officer dead in the chest. The only target presented to that officer, and he did return fire and knocked her down. She lived, fortunately. But the only target presented to that officer was her back, and that was a lawful, justified shooting.
In the Walter Scott case, I don't know if there was any evidence as to whether or not the officer even had a reason to believe the guy was armed, because I know it turned out he was not armed.
Right, and that's what I'm saying, but he pled guilty, so obviously the system worked in that case.
Okay, all right. Now, I know you, one of my other co-hosts interviewed you a couple of years ago, and there was one point you made, which is about the grand jury process and the evidence is presented, et cetera. But at the same time, is that really a check and balance when the grand jury process depends on what the prosecutor introduces to them in way of evidence? And of course, majority of the prosecutors are going to present all the evidence. But if you have a prosecutor who is protective of the police because they're working with the police all the time, if they're protective, they may not present all that evidence to the jury.
Okay.
So
you know, it's really interesting. People bring that up.
One
Go ahead,
thing
I'm sorry.
That some people feel like because of that, maybe they're not being held accountable. So how do you deal with that? Short of, you know, they tried in Ferguson. They tried to get the governor to appoint a special prosecutor and who would not be connected to the police force there to investigate it, and they refused. So you had a prosecutor, and in that case, the prosecutor, his dad had been killed. I think his dad was a police officer.
He was.
And his dad had been killed in line of duty by blackmail. So, of course, people go to suspect that the prosecutor's decision is colored by that incident.
Well, it's actually great that you brought up Ferguson, because that's a perfect example of a lack of bias in the grand jury. The Ferguson DA allowed everybody and anybody who said they had anything to add to speak. That's why it took so long. They interviewed witness after witness after witness. Anybody who said they had anything to say was invited to speak. So when we look at a grand jury and we talk about the bias of the DA, I was down at the Capitol, and we were working on some legislation, and there were 20 district attorneys there. This myth that prosecutors will not prosecute a law enforcement officer is just that. There were 20 DAs there from around the state of Georgia, and one of the DAs asked a question while he was speaking to the panel, how many of you have prosecuted a law enforcement officer? And 19 of them raised their hands. And the one that had not prosecuted an officer had only been in office about 6 or 8 months.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this is what I mean. People don't understand the law, the use of deadly force. They don't understand why the officer was justified. And then when they're found to be wrong, they think there's something wrong with the system. And we see this over and over and over again. You know, I think the hardest words in the English language for people to speak are, I was wrong, or I don't know. Alternatively, depending on who the person is, it's one's harder than the other.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, you mentioned that you had asked how many of the 20 prosecutors had prosecuted police officer.
I didn't. One of the DAs asked.
Okay. But the question, though, would be how narrow of a question was it? Was the DA asking only about excessive force cases or all types of prosecutions? Obviously, if a police officer caught in dealing drugs and is prosecuted, or, you know, maybe felony domestic battery for beating up their wife or something, that's different than prosecuting them for excessive force.
Well, but let me ask you this. The allegation is that there's bias because the prosecutors work with the police every day. So if you have and I'll give you a real-life example. If you have a DA who prosecutes successfully a law enforcement officer who was getting paid for working in the court system and also getting paid for working in his normal job, and the amount literally came up to less than $1,000, that's an opportunity for the DA to have looked the other way, and they didn't. And this notion that police are not held accountable is really laughable. I mean, my office is filled with allegations where officers are accused of wrongdoing, and if they've done something wrong, I want to make sure they get due process like they're entitled to, and if they haven't done something wrong, they deserve an advocate who will take care of them. And this is what I talk about in Blue News. You know, we have the media, and then we have informal media. And I've had officers, and I talk about this in Blue News, I've had officers who are involved in shootings, and the social media, which is what I call the informal media, the blogs, Facebook, Twitter, were so vicious. And the shootings were justified. He was involved in two shootings in about 18 months. Both of the shootings were justified, but the accusations and the threats became so vicious, he left the state.
Okay, this is Craig LeBone. We do have Lance LaRusso on, and we are talking about police-involved shootings and the perspective of police officers and some issues around that. welcome back, Lance.
Thank you.
The starting cast before the break, Betty Shelby, which was the officer in Oklahoma who had a jury trial and was just acquitted. What do you know about that case in terms of it was video from the helicopter? I don't know if there were any other video, if the officer was wearing a body cam or any of that. But
she didn't have a body camera on, but there were some dash cameras.
Okay. So what did the video show? And if it's, I know when it happened, I think it was the police chief down there said he was appalled about what happened, but didn't really go into any details. So what do you know about that?
Sure. The first thing that I saw was the camera from the video from the feed in the helicopter and people condemning the officer based on that feed, which was taken 200 or 300 feet off the ground. I actually wrote a blog post about this, and it was amazing to me that people were willing to condemn her with one of the only views of a camera that we know she did not have, which is part of the problem with using video to decide whether officers did something appropriate. Now, in the context, and this is a great case to point up the issues with Graham versus Connor, judging someone from the office, the perspective of a reasonable law enforcement officer. And when you look at the reasonable officer in that situation, the first thing that we see is a vehicle parked across the roadway, literally on the WL line. That's the first thing that I saw when I saw that video. That's obviously what the officer saw. Then we had a suspect who was not listening to commands when he was being told not to go back to the vehicle. Well, why would an officer not want someone to go back to the vehicle? Well, the biggest reason is we know from experience that officers have been shot and killed or stabbed and killed by people who have retrieved a weapon from a vehicle. Third, there is a training video that we watch and we show in the police academy. I still do a lot of training. And the video involves a deputy named Kyle Dinkheller who was shot and killed by a man who he allowed to go back to a vehicle. The man grabbed a rifle, loaded it, and shot him and killed him at his patrol car. So when the suspect went back to his vehicle and then reached in, now keep in mind the context. People watch it and say, well, he's reaching in. He is reaching in while he is being told over and over again by two uniformed law enforcement officers, show us your hands, don't reach inside the vehicle, stop where you are, stop reaching inside the vehicle. When he reached inside the vehicle, the officer is very concerned and should be concerned based on her training and the history of use of force against officers that he's trying to retrieve a weapon. Now, this is where Hollywood gets involved. In Hollywood, the person would retrieve the weapon and start pulling it out of the car, and the officer would shoot them before they got a shot off. That's fiction. If he was able to retrieve a weapon, say, from the front seat of the car, he would get shots off before, just because of the action-reaction time, he would get shots off before Betty Shelby would be able to shoot him. And the officer has to see a threat, process the threat, and react to the threat. The suspect will always get the first shot.
All right. You talked about helicopter video there, that she did not have body cam. Do body cams give a better perspective of what the officer is actually perceiving?
Better, but not complete. There's a lot of things that the officer will see, other things that the officer will be able to observe that will never be able to be picked up, body language, for example. And as I said, anybody who's ever done any photography, it's incredibly difficult to mimic the human eye. So when you have a camera, now her shooting was in daylight, but most of the shootings that occur, better than 60% of the shootings that occur with law enforcement officers, happen in low light or no light. And the camera is not going to give you the officer's view of the situation.
And a lot of what we see in the media, and let me have you respond to this, whether it's a myth or whatever, is that officers seem to be more apt to use excessive force. Let me say deadly force, because deadly force is not always excessive.
Exactly.
So they're more likely to use deadly force in cases involving people of color as opposed to white people.
That's actually been fundamentally disproved. There was a study done by a Harvard economics professor who looked specifically at that issue, and he absolutely said that Hispanic and black suspects in five or six major metropolitan cities that he looked at were far less likely to be shot by police than white suspects. That has been roundly disproved, even by the New York Post. There was a study done by a professor in Ohio about using UCR statistics, which are Uniform Crime Report statistics. It's a taxonomy done to normalize crimes throughout the United States, because breaking into a car in Georgia may be one crime and breaking into a car in California may be another crime, but they normalize them so they can gather statistics. So they looked at the number of black males that were shot by police and tried to determine whether law enforcement officers were targeting black males. They looked at 4 years inclusive, 2009 through 2012. What they found was that officers shot and killed approximately 120 black males every year of the approximate 1,000 people who were shot and killed by law enforcement. 120 were black males. During those same 4 years, 160 black males on average were shot and killed by private citizens unrelated to the police in justifiable homicides. But the statistic that is most alarming, especially to law enforcement, is during those 4 years, on average, 4,166 black males were killed in criminal acts unrelated to law enforcement. So that statistic that you're citing has been roundly disproved. Law enforcement is not out hunting down black males, and by an overwhelming majority, law enforcement officers shoot far more suspects who are white than black or Hispanic. And then when you pile on to those 4 years that I just mentioned, in those 4 years, law enforcement officers made 52 million custodial arrests. 52 million custodial arrests. Officers arrest between 12 and 13 million people every year. I don't mean traffic tickets, which may technically be an arrest in some states. I'm talking putting handcuffs on a person, taking them to jail. 12 to 13 million times a year. So in those 4 years, you had 52 million arrests made, 480 black males shot and killed, and an average of 4,000, a little less than 4,000 total shot and killed in those 4 years, and only 480 were black males. So that statistic is not only spurious, it has absolutely been roundly disproven. And in the case of the Harvard study, people came out and said that the professor who came out with that statistic, that he was being racist. He is actually an economics professor. He is one of the youngest professors to ever receive tenure at Harvard, and he is the youngest African-American professor to ever receive tenure at Harvard University.
Right. So when the case is, let's say that there's a determination, the police force determines that the deadly force was excessive.
Okay.
How do they go about determining whether it's criminal in nature because of bias on the part of the officer, or whether it's a training issue and what they need to do?
Well, if it's a criminal issue, it's a criminal issue. I mean, the internal investigation is going to look at whether or not the officer violated policy, So starting first with the motivation of the officer to take the action, that would be the criminal part of it or the federal criminal investigation. When you're talking about a training issue, what you would first look at is how the officer reacted to whatever threat they were dealing with and whatever situation they rolled up on, whether they were dispatched to it, whether they rolled up on it just as a part of their normal patrol activities. And then you would go back to the trainers to determine whether or not they reacted according to their training or contrary to their training. But when you talk about a person acting, breaking the law, and being motivated by racial animus, for example, that's a matter of proof for the criminal courts.
How do they investigate it, though? I mean, like, how would they determine whether or not it was racially motivated or a training issue? What are some of the
they ask they questions, they interview people, and these homicide interviews that officers go through when they shoot people, it's not a coffee session. It's actually an investigation. And that's why it takes a long time for these investigations to be done. People want to look at the video and they say, okay, well, the officer did something wrong or didn't do something wrong. They want quick answers. But if you want a thorough investigation, it takes time. So, and I'll give you an example. I represented an officer in a shooting. And there was an allegation that the officer shot the person because they were black. And there was a witness who made comments that were consistent with the officer's story on the scene. And they said, okay, from what he saw, we believe, you know, they looked at his vantage point, they went to where he was standing, they looked at similar light, could he have seen what he saw? And his statement supported the officer. The next day he made a statement to the media that was completely contrary. And they went out there and re-interviewed him and said, what's the truth? And he had lied to the media.
All right. We just have a couple minutes left, and so before we run out of time, I want to give you a chance to, if you have a website, to give out your web address.
Sure.
And you, for the what address they use to read your blogs.
Sure. The blog is BlueLineLawyer.com. And the books can be found at Amazon. They can also be found on LanceLoRussoBooks.com. And I said all the profits go to law enforcement charities. I think we've donated about $17,000 to law enforcement charities now in the past 5 years. And that's a great way for people to find the books and through the website and the blog. And also, obviously, you can find them on Amazon.
All right. And so another question I wanted to ask is that oftentimes there's cases where officers prosecuted, they're found not guilty, but then they're prosecuted by the federal government and they're convicted in those cases. What's the difference and why does that happen and why would... why would a jury at state level maybe say there's not excessive force, but at the federal level that jury says there is excessive force?
Because they're completely different standards.
All right. So for the audience to understand that a little bit more.
Sure. In the criminal case, what you're trying, in the state level criminal case, you're trying to look at whether or not the officer violated a criminal statute, and you have to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. In the federal, you're trying to prove that the reason the officer took the actions they took was with the intent to violate the constitutional rights of the person who was shot or injured. That's one of the reasons why normally it happens in the reverse, that if the officer is cleared on the state level, the charges are never brought on the federal level. That's one of the reasons, like in the George Zimmerman shooting, once the he was acquitted of the state charges, there was never a follow-up prosecution because his actions were deemed justified under the law.
All right. And the last question I have real quick.
I'm sorry, Craig, but we are out of time. We do want to remind everyone that the phone number is 888-931-0901. That's 888-931-0901. Call in now. Thank you.
This is Bill Claus asking you to support KKFI, your community radio station where you hear radio like you've never heard it before. Want to know what makes KKFI different than any other radio station in town? It's the tremendous support we receive from community volunteers, support that allows us to stretch and multiply your financial donations many times over. Volunteers take many roles at KKFI, whether they're on the board of directors, on the active members committee, on the programming committee, or they just answer the phones during the pledge drive, they stuff envelopes. But most impressive of all is the cadre of nearly 100 volunteer show programmers that have devoted untold numbers of hours organizing and engineering shows for broadcast. Think of it, every hour of every day for every month for a quarter century, whether it's 3 a.m. on Monday morning, 5 a.m. on Sunday morning, noon on Christmas Day, or midnight on New Year's Eve, there has been, is, and will be one and usually more unpaid volunteers on duty at KKFI. This donation of literally hundreds of thousands of volunteer hours means that your dollars are stretched and multiplied many times over. Rather than requiring funds to cover the cost of paid on-air talent and a large office staff, your donations go directly to supporting quality community radio programming. If you want entertainment and information that you cannot get anywhere else, if you share KKFI's mission, then call 888-931-0901. Make your pledge now. That's 888-931-0901. Or go online at kkfi.org. Make your pledge now. Call now, 888-931-0901.
It's the 420 drug war news. Can somebody please tell me why this drug war is destined to last forever? Well, there was a lot of propaganda about 100 years ago that made it all possible. The following, courtesy National Geographic, it features Dr. Carl Hart, professor of psychology at Columbia University.
As soon as the colonists set foot in the New World, they started growing cannabis like grass. Also farming the stuff like a bunch of Paul Bunyan Willie Nelsons. Not to get high, but because it was the law in Virginia to grow the stuff. Because the plant fibers were so tough and versatile that they could be used for everything. From sails and rigging on ships, to new duds, and even paper.
When we think about America's relationship with marijuana, we have to first understand that marijuana was called many things throughout the history. And all of those sort of different names mean different things to different individuals.
Now, where did smoking really take off? Where did it really become a cultural thing?
From High Times, Steve Hager.
In Mexico, when they imported the Chinese laborers to build the railroads, they brought opium and cannabis, and the Mexicans really got into the cannabis. Now, Pancho Villa, he only smoked big stogies. And I think the best evidence of that is that the marching song of his army was called La Cucaracha, which is a song about marijuana smoking.
But Uncle Sam and his southern neighbor, they didn't always get along. And by the 1930s, cannabis got caught up in anti-immigration sentiments, and the government renamed it marijuana to give it a negative association. Then, Harry Jacob Anslinger, the first head of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, got a law called the Marijuana Tax Act passed in 1937. By spitting jive like the drug made users loco, violent, and sex crazed.
Come here, Daddy. You look so good.
In the 30s, 29 states straight up outlawed cannabis, and we got the first and last government-sponsored stoner movie, Reefer Madness.
More deadly even than these soul-destroying drugs is the menace of marijuana.
If you think about what happened during Reefer Madness, it was a film that exaggerated the harmful effects of marijuana. Hearst needs to sell newspapers. And you think about the stories that were written about marijuana at this time. These were stories that were appealing to the public then and now. And the same sort of formula works today.
Yeah, Dean Becker, DrugTruth.net.
We hope you've enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and the guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, or its staff and volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice radio page on Facebook. If you have a show idea or you want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live on the KKFI website at kkfi.org. This is your engineer for Jaws of Justice Radio, Beth Pike. And be sure to tune in Thursday mornings at 6 a.m. when I host the Thirsty Thursday edition of your Morning Buzz. Our outro music is Better Man, and that's from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Khadija and the White Guy at 9 a.m. on Thursdays, and then Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 on Fridays. Up next is Beautician's Blues. That's with Luscious Lynn. And then at noon, it's Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. You'll want to stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon, and then Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo en Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.